Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we are diving deep into something, well, fundamental. Sleep, that thing we all do, but maybe don't appreciate enough.
Absolutely. And we're looking at it through the lens of some real heavyweights in neuroscience, Stephen Lockley and Russell Foster, and their book, Sleep. A very short introduction.
It feels like the perfect time, doesn't it? Because culturally, we still seem so almost aggressive towards sleep, like it's downtime, wasted time, maybe.
Or worse, the sign of weakness, you know,
yeah.
Failing to be productive 24/7. But the science, especially from these guys, it just flips that script completely.
Right. They frame sleep as the third pillar of health, just as vital as diet and exercise. Non-negotiable.
Exactly. And that's our mission today, really, to get into the why. Why is it so crucial? And why is our modern world, our 24/7 culture, so fundamentally out of sync with our biology?
Yeah, we want to give you the tools, the scientific understanding to see beyond the sort of sleep guilt, maybe. Understand this epidemic of sleep deprivation.
We're going beyond just the usual tips. We're diving into the actual mechanics. What is the brain doing when you're asleep? How is it all regulated? That's the core framework.
Okay, let's start with the guys themselves, Lockley and Foster. These aren't just writers. They're scientists who actually defined a lot of this field. Stephen Lockley.
Right, Harvard Medical School.
Yeah.
Neuroscientist. But what's really interesting about him is the application side. He takes the lab science into the real world.
Applied circadian science. What does that mean in practice?
Well, think about extreme environments. He's worked with NASA on astronaut sleep schedules. He advises governments, industries on managing fatigue, especially for like shift workers.
Ah, okay. So where biology meets high stakes performance and safety.
Exactly. And then there's Russell Foster at Oxford. His work is, well, it's foundational. He discovered something that literally changed our understanding of light and the body.
You mean the third type of photoreceptor in the eye? Not just rods and cones.
Precisely. The intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, IPRGCs. These cells aren't primarily for seeing images. They talk directly to the brain's master clock.
So they tell the brain what time it is based on environmental light, bypassing vision altogether.
That's the gist of it. It was a groundbreaking discovery, so you put them together.
You get the scientist who found the light sensor for the clock and the scientist who applies that knowledge to keep people safe and functional. That's some serious authority.
Unparalleled, really, when it comes to the science of sleep and circadian rhythms.
Okay, so the book itself, what's the big takeaway message?
The absolute core premise is that sleep isn't passive downtime. It's a highly active, incredibly complex, and biologically essential process, crucial for physical health, mental sharpness, even survival.
It's a direct challenge to that sleep is for the weak idea.
Completely. And I like how they build the case. They start with the basics. What are the stages of sleep? You know, the architecture.
Right, like NREM and REM.
Yeah. And then they move into the control system, the two-process model, which explains why you feel tired or alert.
So it's not just rules, it's the underlying mechanics.
Exactly. And once you understand those mechanics, their critique of modern society makes so much sense. How our 24/7 demands, the constant light, it's just fundamentally clashing with our biology.
And that clash isn't just making us groggy. They argue it's a public health crisis.
A systemic one. So the goal here, and in the book, is to empower you with that knowledge, to move past simple sleep hygiene tips, though those matter, and understand the bigger picture.
So you can advocate for yourself, but also maybe understand the need for bigger changes. It's not just a personal failing if you're exhausted all the time.
Precisely. It's often a mismatch between your biology and your environment.
Okay, let's dig into some of the details. Chapter one, the architecture. NREM versus REM, what's happening?
Right, so sleep isn't monolithic. We cycle through stages. NREM has stages 1, 2, and 3. N3 is the really deep, slow wave sleep.
That's the one often called deep sleep, right? What's his main job?
That's where a lot of the heavy lifting for physical restoration happens. Protein synthesis, tissue repair, growth hormone release. It's major body maintenance time.
Okay, but then there's this newer discovery. They talk about the glymphatic system. Sounds interesting.
It's fascinating. Think of it as the brain's dedicated cleaning crew, or maybe a plumbing system. It becomes highly active during deep N3 sleep.
Cleaning crew? What's good cleaning?
Metabolic waste products that build up during the day, including neurotoxins like amyloid beta.
Wait, amyloid beta? Isn't that the protein linked to Alzheimer's disease?
That's the one. During deep sleep, the spaces between brain cells actually expand slightly, allowing cerebrospinal fluid to flush through and wash away this waste.
Wow. So sleep isn't just rest, it's literally taking out the brain's trash. If you cut N3 short, the trash piles up.
That seems to be the implication. Really highlights the importance of that deep restorative sleep. Now, contrast that with REM sleep.
REM, rapid eye movement. That's the paradoxical state, right?
Exactly. Your brain activity during REM looks remarkably similar to when you're awake. Highly active. That's where most vivid narrative dreaming happens.
But your body is essentially paralyzed.
Right. It's called atonia. Your major muscle groups are inhibited. It's a crucial safety feature, really.
So you don't start acting out your dreams. Makes sense.
Very clever biology. Okay, so that's what the brain is doing, but what tells it when to sleep and when to wake? That brings us to Chapter 5 and the two-process model.
Yes, the master key, you called it. Process S and Process C. Let's start with S, homeostatic drive.
Yeah, Process S is basically your sleep pressure. Think of it like a debt building up. The longer you're awake, the more pressure accumulates.
And what causes that pressure?
A chemical called adenosine. It's a natural byproduct of energy use in the brain. More awake time, more energy used, more adenosine builds up.
Okay, so adenosine signals time to rest. Which brings us to caffeine. How does that fit in?
Ah, caffeine. It's basically an adenosine impersonator. It binds to the same receptors in your brain that adenosine uses.
But it doesn't activate them. It just blocks adenosine.
Exactly. It blocks the signal.
Yeah.
So your brain doesn't feel the pressure building up, even though the adenosine is still there. It's like putting tape over a warning light.
A temporary cheat code.
Yeah.
Until the caffeine wears off.
And all that accumulated adenosine hits you. Hence the crash. But that pressure, Process S, that's only one part of the equation.
Right. There's also Process C, the circadian pacemaker.
Yeah.
The internal clock.
Yep. This is your body's own internal 24-hour timer located in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SEN, deep in the brain. It dictates rhythms of alertness and sleepiness across the day and night.
Regardless of how much sleep you got last night.
Largely, yes. It drives things like your core body temperature rhythm, hormone release patterns like melatonin for sleepiness and cortisol for alertness, and that classic mid-afternoon dip in energy.
So even if Process S pressure is low because you slept well, if Process C says it's 3 a.m., you're going to feel groggy because the clock is signaling low performance time.
Precisely. It's the interplay between these two processes, the rising sleep pressure, S, and the clock-driven alertness signal, C, that determines how sleepy or awake you feel at any given moment.
And Process C needs to stay synced with the outside world, right? How does it do that?
The primary cue, the master Zeitgeber or time giver, is light, especially the timing and intensity of light detected by those IPRGCs we mentioned Foster discovered.
Got it. Okay, let's apply this framework. Chapter 6 talks about teenagers. We all know they struggle with mornings, but the authors say it's not just laziness.
Not at all. It's biology. During puberty, there's a well-documented phenomenon called phase delay. Their internal clock, Process C, shifts later.
How much later?
Typically 2 to 3 hours. This means their natural melatonin release, which signals sleepiness, doesn't start until maybe 10:30 or 11 p.m. or even later.
So biologically, they're not ready for sleep until late and therefore need to wake up later to get enough rest.
Exactly. They still need 8 to 10 hours. So if they're biologically programmed to fall asleep around 11 p.m., waking them at 6:30 or 7 a.m. for school.
Is like forcing an adult to wake up and function at 4 a.m. Ouch.
It puts them into a state of chronic sleep deprivation, like perpetual jet lag. And the consequences are serious poor academic performance, higher rates of anxiety and depression, increased risk-taking, even drowsy driving.
So the authors are pretty blunt about the solution.
Absolutely. They argue strongly that later school start times for adolescents aren't just a nice idea. They're a public health necessity based on clear biological evidence.
This mismatch isn't just for teens, though. Chapter 8 expands it to society overall, right? The 2047 world.
Yes. They point to major disasters where human error linked to fatigue was a critical factor. Think Chernobyl, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the Challenger space shuttle explosion.
Wow, so sleep deprivation isn't just personal discomfort, it's a genuine safety risk on a large scale.
Definitely. And a huge contributing factor is artificial light. Electric light, especially the blue wavelength light from our screens, has allowed us to essentially ignore the natural day-night cycle.
We've colonized the night, as they put it.
Right. And that evening light exposure actively suppresses melatonin production, pushes our internal clock later and puts us in direct conflict with our biology.
And then there's the cultural pressure, the hustle culture that seems to celebrate sleep deprivation.
Yeah, they critique that strongly. Treating sleep sacrifice as a badge of honor is, well, biologically damaging. Chronic circadian disruption messes with everything, metabolism, hormone regulation.
Leading to increased risks for things like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. It's a heavy price.
A very heavy price for ignoring a fundamental biological need.
Okay, let's pull back and look at the big themes. We've covered a lot. What's the first key message you think we should take away?
For me, the absolute bedrock is sleep is active brain maintenance, not passive rest.
Right. That reframing is crucial, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just shutting down. It's like running essential system updates and cleanup routines.
Exactly. The glymphatic system, clearing out toxins, memory consolidation, it's vital work that can only happen properly during sleep. Skipping sleep means skipping that maintenance.
Okay, theme number two.
Light is the master key to the body clock.
Because of those IPRGCs,
yeah.
It's not just about vision.
Not at all. Light is the most powerful signal telling your internal clock what time it is in the external world. So managing your light exposure, getting bright light in the morning, avoiding bright blue light at night is probably the single most effective way to support your circadian rhythm.
Makes sense. And the third big theme.
Sleep deprivation is a public health crisis, not just a personal failing.
Yeah, that really comes through. The issue is bigger than individual willpower.
It's systemic. Our work schedules, school times, the light environment, they're often fundamentally at odds with our biology. So we need to think about societal solutions, not just individual try-harder approaches.
Okay, the book also has some really memorable lines that capture these ideas.
It does. They condense complex science into really impactful statements.
Like this one about why sleep even exists. If sleep does not serve an absolutely vital function, then it is the biggest mistake the evolutionary process has ever made.
That just perfectly frames the stakes, doesn't it? Evolution doesn't favor vulnerability. Spending hours unconscious and defenseless must provide an enormous biological advantage to have persisted. It tells you sleep is utterly critical.
And the one about teenagers, which is so clear and empathetic, asking a teenager to be awake and alert at 7 a.m. is like asking an adult to be at their best at 4 a.m.
Yeah, that instantly conveys the biological reality of the phase delay. It shifts the perspective from lazy teen to unrealistic schedule. Really powerful for driving policy discussions.
And finally, reinforcing the power of light. Light is not just for vision. It's the primary signal our brains use to keep our internal clocks synchronized with the external world.
Simple, direct, and underscores why light management is so fundamental. It's a physiological signal, not just illumination.
So let's talk practical applications. Based on this, what can people actually do? Light management seems key.
Absolutely. The most actionable advice is probably around light. Try to get 15, 30 minutes of natural sunlight exposure, ideally within the first hour of waking up.
That helps anchor the clock for the day.
Precisely. It's a strong start the day signal for your SCN. And conversely, in the evening, you want to do the opposite. Dim the lights in your home 2-3 hours before bed.
And minimize that blue light from screens. Use night modes, filters.
Definitely. Avoid bright blue-toned light to allow your natural melatonin production to rise, signaling to your body that it's time to wind down. Warm, dim lighting is much better.
Okay, what about managing alertness during the day, thinking about the two-process model?
Well, recognize that mid-afternoon slump. It's often a natural dip in the process-y alertness signal instead of just pounding caffeine.
Which just blocks adenosine temporarily.
Right. Consider scheduling less demanding work then. Or if possible, take a short power nap like 20 to 30 minutes. That can actually reduce some of the process as sleep pressure without causing grogginess from deep sleep.
And being mindful of substances. Caffeine's long half-life.
Yeah, caffeine sticks around for about 5-7 hours for most people. So having it late in the afternoon or evening can definitely interfere with process S building up enough pressure for you to fall asleep easily.
And alcohol may make you drowsy, but...
It severely disrupts sleep architecture. It particularly suppresses REM sleep, which is vital for cognitive functions. So while it might help you nod off, the quality of sleep is significantly worse. You wake up feeling unrefreshed.
Good reminders.
Mm.
Okay, wrapping up. What was the most surprising thing you took away from diving into this?
For me, honestly, it's still the glymphatic system, the idea that the brain has this dedicated, active cleaning process that primarily runs during sleep. It just fundamentally changes how you view sleep. It's not rest. It's essential active work, neuromaintenance.
Yeah, that's a powerful image.
Yeah.
And what do you think is the most valuable lesson for someone listening?
I think it's understanding that framework, the two-process model. Knowing that your sleepiness is this dynamic interplay between sleep pressure building up, process S, and your internal clock's rhythm, process C. It helps you understand why you feel the way you do and maybe feel less guilty and more empowered to work with your biology instead of constantly fighting it.
Living in sync with the clock, not against it. Okay, final provocative thought. If sleep is that third pillar, and our environment is often hostile to it, what's the next big policy change needed? Reforming shift work schedules, or maybe mandating circadian-friendly lighting in public buildings?
Ooh, that's tough. Both are needed. But given Lockley's work on fatigue management and the sheer scale of shift work, addressing those danger schedules, finding ways to mitigate the circadian disruption for millions of workers, that feels incredibly urgent from a public health and safety perspective. The risks there are just so immediate and potentially catastrophic.
A lot to think about, definitely. Making sleep a societal priority, not just a personal one. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.